Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. We have a fish story about the big one that got away. In fact, thousands of big ones that got away. A project has Greenland salmon fishermen being paid not to fish. We'll explain. And Professor Stuart Licht is inventing a sulfur aluminum battery with exciting possibilities for the electric car industry.
We're hoping you could just go in, leave off your discharged aluminum, your discharged sulfur, get a new plate of aluminum, a new portion of sulfur, and drive the car off. It would be like refueling at a gas station. So you just get new components. And then the aluminum and the sulfur would be recharged at another site.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. In Greenland, the month of August is a busy time for Inuit fishermen. This is the salmon run. The Inuit have just a few weeks, really, to haul in enough salmon for a yearly salary. But this year, it is quiet. The nets are in the warehouses, the boats are tied up at wharf, and the fishermen are idle. Meanwhile, off the coast, in the Gulf Stream waters of the North Atlantic, salmon run free. The Inuit fishermen are being paid not to fish.
The terms of the agreement provide that 100% less 12 metric tons of their anticipated harvest would be purchased in both 1993 and 1994 at a cost of $400,000 U.S. annually.
David Clark, president of the Atlantic Salmon Federation, based in the seaside town of St. Andrews, New Brunswick, Canada. The annual haul is set each year by another organization, the North Atlantic Salmon Conservation Organization, a sort of international treaty organization. NASCO sets the limits for salmon fishermen on both sides of the Atlantic. An American submarine discovered the Greenland salmon feeding grounds in the 1950s. Nearly immediately, fishermen descended on the region. Until recently, over 800 metric tons of salmon were dragged from the ocean there each year. But then the catch began to decline. Today, the fishermen would be lucky to get 225 tons, which happens to be the figure in the agreement. The fishermen will be allowed to take only 12 tons of salmon. For the rest, the 213 tons, the fishermen will be paid $400,000 this year and next to leave behind. The 12 tons will be allowed for subsistence purposes. The Inuit live from the sea. Clark says this project, involving both private and public sector money from the United States, is being seen as a last-ditch effort to save the salmon from extinction.
The commercial fishery has long been recognized as the most serious difficulty faced by Atlantic salmon in their quest to survive. Over the years, they've taken hundreds and thousands of metric tons of fish. The Atlantic salmon, of course, is what we call an anadromous fish. It lives, feeds, and grows in salt water, but it is born and it reproduces in fresh water, and it returns to its natal river after growing in the ocean to reproduce. And on that migratory journey is where the fish has been intercepted by the commercial nets in Greenland, by commercial nets in Newfoundland and Labrador in Canada, and up until the early 1980s by commercial nets in Atlantic Canada, that's New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island, and somewhat in the province of Quebec.
Do you feel, or is it felt, that this will be sufficient tonnage left in the ocean to provide stock for the regeneration of the population?
Well, if we could state it another way, there are two components to a salmon population. Salmon, depending on the genetic strain, will go to sea for 1, 2, or 3 years. The one-year fish come back, and they're sexually mature, they reproduce, but we refer to them as grilse. They're in the 4 to 6 pound range and, around 2 feet long. The longer they stay out there, if they stay out for 2 winters before they come back to spawn for the first time, they'll be fish in the 8-10 pound range. And if they stay out for 3 winters, they'll probably be 12, 14, 15 pounds when they come back. The bigger fish are highly prized. What the 2- and 3C winter fish, or what we call multi-C winter fish, are highly prized because they tend to be 80% female. And as a rule of thumb, we say that a female is probably carrying 800 eggs per pound of body weight. So a 10-pound fish is carrying 8,000 eggs. It takes 8,000 eggs laid down on the spawning bed to produce, with attrition, one breeding pair. So a 10-pound fish is going to produce a single breeding pair in a reproductive season. A 20-pound fish, 2 pair. A 30-pound fish, 3 pair. And that's why we value the larger fish so highly. The grilse, on the other hand, the 1C winter fish, tend to be 80% female, or 80% male, I'm sorry. They are not so important. And what we know about the 2 and 3C winter fish is that their numbers have depleted enormously, and we are now below the level necessary in many, many rivers just to maintain a population. And we have to take all the pressure off them in order to allow them to recover, or we're going to continue on this declining track.
Clark mentions rivers. Though salmon mature at sea, they breed in freshwater rivers. On the East Coast, the salmon typically return to the Penobscot River in Maine or the Connecticut River in Connecticut and Massachusetts, rivers that are both polluted and blocked by hydroelectric dams, rivers that are daunting, if not toxic, to the health of the salmon. However, Clark dismisses the argument that buying out the Greenland fishermen is failing to see these other threats.
What you have to appreciate is that the successful negotiation of an accommodation with the Greenlanders is a big stroke victory. That is, it is a relief of pressure that was being applied to all salmon stocks from all rivers in eastern North America, wherever they originated. The kinds of things that you're making reference to affect the stocks in specific rivers once they've gotten home. And the numbers of fish that may be involved in an undesirable situation, whether it's a hydroelectric facility or whether it's municipal pollution or agricultural runoff or clear-cutting operations, might be a relatively small number of fish that are being affected at the present time. The spawning population of a river like the Penobscot is a couple of thousand fish, whereas the Greenlanders were having an impact on hundreds of thousands of fish. So by solving that problem, we have brought relief to most North American rivers. That's not to say that we're not attentive to those problems within rivers, but like all conservation organizations, we have limited resources, and we've got to try and utilize those resources in the areas where they'll do the most good. And that's why we so enthusiastically pursued and embraced an agreement with the Greenlanders.
The agreement provides $800,000 for 2 years. $500,000 of that will come from the Atlantic Salmon Federation. $250,000 will come from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization. Another $50,000 will be contributed by the United States State Department. It is thus an international agreement, regulating a national activity. Clark says, however, we should not look upon this as a strong-arm tactic by the United States to regulate the activities of another nation.
I don't think that's the right spin to put on it. What the U.S. government did was recognize that the people of the United States have committed an enormous amount of money over the last 25 years attempting to restore Atlantic salmon to the range of migration within the territorial continental United States, state of Maine, state of Connecticut. And they were, first of all, I think, trying to protect that investment, and secondly, recognizing that there is an enormous potential economic spin-off for those areas where salmon have been restored, if they can be successfully restored, in the as a tourism generator, bringing anglers to the state to leave money behind because they want to pursue this wonderful game fish. And they did not get involved directly. The U.S. government did not get involved directly in the negotiations. They did not get involved directly with the Greenland government. What they did was they committed financial support to this initiative to negotiate an accommodation with the Greenlanders, but that negotiation was done privately and independently of governments.
David Clark, president of the Atlantic Salmon Federation based in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, Canada. The salmon buyout is hoped to restore the salmon population in the North Atlantic. However, there is an economic question rising from this issue, namely whether the $400,000 to be paid the Inuit fishermen this year and next is sufficient. After all, the money is based on a quota of what the fishermen would have gotten had they gone out to fish, 213 tons, drastically down from the one-time high of 800 tons. If the fishermen were living near the poverty level from declining catches, will this project ensure they remain in that state? Then again, what is the real issue here? Declining salmon populations, or the dignity of Aboriginal people? This is Bruce Robertson. One gardener says, prune your flowering bushes in the fall after the growing season. Another says, prune them in the spring, right after the blooms are gone. For those of us thoroughly confused and with a lot of plants that just aren't blooming the way they used to, Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, has some advice. Advice, he says, is best using visual aids. Let's go for a quick lesson.
Whoa! Tim Burr, I guess.
Hey, Larry.
Bruce.
You look like like the woodsman here.
Yeah, well, I'm pruning the some dead wood out of this Rose of Sharon.
Getting rid of the dead wood, huh?
Yeah, I like this. I like a Rose of Sharon bush, a shrub like this, but, you know, you got to get the dead wood out of it. And now's a good time to get the dead wood out of it. And I'll run that through my shredder and turn it into mulch.
Okay, this is a fall season. You're doing a little pruning here. Is this, in fact, a good time to do pruning?
Well, it's always a good time to prune out dead wood in any kind of shrub or bush. But actually, fall is probably the worst time to prune shrubbery. And the reason for that is because if you prune your shrubbery now, it won't bloom next spring. You wouldn't want to do that.
Well, I have let me try on this as an example. I have a forsythia bush that I mm-hmm. transplanted a couple of years ago, and for a long while it wasn't doing anything. It was just sort of sitting there. Didn't die, but it didn't grow either. Then mm-hmm. all of a sudden this past summer, the thing took off, and it has nice long tendrils that are shooting out. And I'm just itching to go out there and prune them back. I'm worried that they might not make it through the winter with a heavy snow falling
on it.
They're
a little stocky and
yeah,
sinewy, sort of?
Sinewy, yeah. But you're saying this is not a good time of year to prune them back.
Well, I would say that with a forsythia, you could give it a little bit of a trim now because they bloom all up and down. They don't really have true blooms. They have their leaves that come out and form a bloom and all up and down the length of their stem. On the whole, a spring blooming shrub, if you prune it now, you're going to be pruning off all of its blooming potential for next year because it forms its flowers on the growth that it had all this summer. Let me show you over here. I have a big flowering quince here. And you can see that it's about 8 or 9 or even 10 feet tall.
Yeah.
And it probably should be pruned and sort of flattened and trimmed up. But if I wanted to do that now, if I got around to doing that now, I wouldn't have any of those beautiful pink blossoms like I would have, if I left all that on there. So a lot of people make the big mistake if they get out in the fall and they go, oh, look, this thing's a wreck, and they just prune, and they don't realize that I've done it to this myself before I knew what I was doing. And they wait in the next spring, there's no blossoms, they don't know why. Now, there's also summer flowering shrubbery, and I have some of that over there. That's hydrangea. Now, that is something that you don't prune in the spring. You prune that in the late winter, just like if you're going to prune apple trees right before the new growth begins, before the sap starts to flow, before all the excitement of springtime starts up. That's the time you prune back summer blooming shrubbery like a hydrangea. But for spring blooming shrubbery, you prune that just after it completes its bloom, such as the lilac. After the lilac is done with its big, beautiful blossoms, and they're all brown now and they don't look good anymore, that's the time to prune them. So that otherwise, you're not going to have the blooms.
Okay, Larry, thanks for the good tips, and happy pruning.
Well, now that you got me on this this bush over here, I am going to prune out some dead wood over here.
Okay, well, I'll leave you to it, Larry. See you next time.
Come by any time.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His well-pruned bushes form a substantial part of his backyard in Hollowville, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The environmental movement may get a boost from an experimental battery. Professor Stuart Licht has developed a sulfur aluminum battery that can store more of a charge and hold that charge longer than a typical alkaline battery. While the battery would be a clear benefit to industry, environmentalists are also enthusiastic about its prospects. Unlike most other batteries on the market, the sulfur aluminum battery is composed of harmless and readily abundant materials. In addition, the battery's lightweight and storage capacity make it ideal for the electric car industry. Jim Ormond keeps on going with this story.
The research of a Clark University professor is proving that industrial innovation and environmental preservation can go hand in hand. Professor Stuart Licht's sulfur aluminum battery is more energy efficient than other batteries on the market. For example, a common alkaline battery used in a flashlight can store 95 watt-hours per kilogram of the battery weight and discharge for about 6.5 hours. The sulfur aluminum model can store 220 watt-hours per kilogram of battery weight and can discharge for up to 17 hours.
Sulfur is an unusual material to store energy with, and we became very excited about that. That, in turn, led to a search for an efficient material to couple with the sulfur, and that turned out to be aluminum. And at this point, we've developed a fairly efficient aluminum-sulfur battery.
The environmental impacts of such a battery are wide-ranging. For example, sulfur and aluminum are both abundant and easily obtainable. Heavy mining is required to obtain the chemicals used in conventional batteries.
We know that aluminum is very prevalent. It's the most common element in the Earth's crust. And sulfur is also very prevalent. It's interesting that sulfur we get out of cleaning up oil. So we have huge amounts of piles of sulfur building up due to desulfurization of petroleum products. So we have a great deal of aluminum and sulfur available. They're both found readily in nature. They would both be recycled over and over again as the battery's charged and discharged.
Oh, okay, so they could be continually recycled. How would they break down in nature? I know there's problems of, you know, disposing a typical alkaline battery.
Well, aluminum in its natural form is the mineral bauxite. It's an aluminum oxide found in metal ore. It's very, very common in the Earth's crust again. It's 13.1% of the Earth's crust. And so we wouldn't be worried about that as an environmental contaminant now. Sulfur, we use it readily. It comes out of volcanoes as gas. It's not a very pleasant material once it goes into the gas form. It smells. But we're keeping it in the solid and liquid forms in which it has very little environmental impact. Basically, it should be recycled over and over again, though.
The aluminum sulfur battery also poses less risk to human health. The cadmium in nickel-cadmium batteries is a cancer-causing agent. And then, of course, batteries contain lead.
The EPA is regulating the use of lead more and more. It's reducing the amount of lead that can be found in the environment. We've, of course, taken lead out of gasoline. We don't allow lead pipes now. We don't allow lead-glazed ceramics. And we're disallowing lead paints now, and so it's just it's toxic. It's a toxic material. The more lead we have in circulation in society, the more is bound to be disposed of improperly or not recycled. Mild lead poisoning causes anemia, headaches, sore muscles, irritability, fatigue. It causes dysfunction of kidneys and the liver and the brain, and it can cause sickness or death. I think the big problem with it is it causes mental retardation in children. So it's a very dangerous material to have in large quantities. We can minimize its impact on production, but some of it will escape if we have each car driving around with about a half ton of lead in it.
The prospect of a half ton of lead in each car is what makes the automotive industry and the environmental community so hopeful for the development of the sulfur aluminum battery. The battery may revolutionize the electric car industry. Environmentalists are hoping electric cars will drastically reduce air pollution, especially in areas like Los Angeles, rated as having a severe air pollution problem. Designers in Detroit, however, have been disappointed with the need to constantly recharge electric cars and their lack of acceleration. The sulfur aluminum battery promises to make electric cars more efficient and thus more attractive to consumers.
The interesting and exciting part of using it for electric cars is that we have a number of states legislating the need for electric cars. I think some 13 states now have legislation existing or about to exist in which a growing percentage of the cars sold in the state have to be electrically powered. There isn't a very good battery out there to serve those needs yet, and perhaps this battery can fulfill some of those needs. A battery for an electric car has to allow us to drive a car for about the same range that we're used to, several hundred miles between recharges. It has to be reasonably cost-effective, and of course it has to have a minimal environmental impact, and none of the proposed batteries out there can do that. One of the prime candidates for batteries for electric cars up till now has been lead-acid battery, but it just doesn't work very well. It's very, very heavy. Lead-acid battery technology is about 100 years old. The aluminum sulfur battery can store about six times as much electrical charge compared to the same weight of lead. So rather than having to fill your trunk and your hood and the under flooring of your car with batteries, essentially making it into something that's so heavy that it can't go very far or very fast, we can fill it with a lightweight battery, just hopefully just in the hood, just with the large engine would be before, and have a car which is capable of going quite a bit faster. Right now, the lead-acid battery cars that have been built only go about a maximum of 80 miles between recharges, and we're anticipating that aluminum-sulfur-driven car could go quite a bit further. Since it is lightweight, hopefully it would have better acceleration also. The recharge issue is interesting. We're looking at different forms of aluminum-sulfur battery. One of them is radically different than the way we're thinking about electrical cars up to date. Rather than having a place to charge the car, plug it into a wall, and these recharging times can take up to 6 hours. You'd have to leave the car overnight to recharge it with a lead-acid battery or a nickel-iron or a nickel-cadmium battery. We're hoping you could just go in, leave off your discharged aluminum, your discharged sulfur, get a new plate of aluminum, a new portion of sulfur, and drive the car off. It would be like refueling in a gas station. So you just get new components. And then the aluminum and the sulfur would be recharged at another site. So you'd be able to drive in and drive out quickly. We call that a mechanical recharge rather than an electrical recharge of the battery.
The uses of this new sulfur aluminum battery are not limited to the transportation sector. Lick sees wide use possible in the utility industry.
A third possible application is, again, one with a great deal of environmental possibilities, and that's for the use of load leveling. Rather than building a lot of power stations, coal or nuclear or oil, you can build fewer stations if you can store that electricity at night, generate the electricity day and night, store some of it at night for use in the daytime when you need more of it. And perhaps the aluminum sulfur battery could be used for these peak power times.
Stuart Licht is professor of chemistry at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. NASA is reportedly interested in testing this new battery on an upcoming shuttle mission. This is Jim Ormond.
And thanks, Jim, for that energizing story. Incidentally, Professor Licht reminds us that Clark University invented the tetramethyl lead gasoline about 80 years ago. That's our report on the Environment Show this week. We had help from Tracy O'Connell. The Environment Show is a program about the environment. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, number 198. The Environment Show is a production of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.